Welcome to another episode of Big Fish Radio. This is Captain Barry. I'm joined with the two hosts, as you guys know, Captain Robert Lugowitz. I just called you Captain.
He you wishes.
No, I do not.
And
let's clarify that.
Call me Captain. Call me Captain.
And Captain Alex.
Be fishing.
Get you your captain's license. It's no big deal. Captain Alex. But today we are going to be talking about cobia. Cobia. I love cobia. They're so tasty.
Cobia, the fish that was a shark and a catfish put together.
If they had a baby, it would be a cobia. Shark and a sail cat having a baby would be a cobia. Is that how they came about, Robert?
Yeah, no. But that's a good way to describe it, though. It's a fairly accurate way to describe it.
When you have people coming in the shop, Robert...
All the time.
I bet, like, what... These people that don't know what a cobia is and they catch one, like, how do they describe it? I'm sure it's, like, the same thing every time.
Almost every time it starts off. At first, I thought it was a shark. And then I got it in closer, and then I kind of thought it was a weird catfish. And then usually I have a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, because I thought it was a shark at first. The two things that pop into my mind is a remora or a cobia. Mm. Those two things always pop into my mind first. Mm. But if they say, then I got it up to the side, and it looked kind of more, a little bit of catfish characteristics to it. You know, it's hard to tell, but most of the time, the first thing is I thought it was a shark, but it wasn't. And then I'm like, okay, that's the two fish I got to narrow down to in my head.
What are remoras bite on?
They'll eat cut bait and live bait.
They will?
Scraps. Yeah, they're not picky at all.
Oh, okay.
No, because they usually hang out around sharks, whale sharks, other large fish. Even, well, they're born small, so I mean, I've even caught them on black drum. You know, you reel in a black drum and have a little baby remora to it. Actually, you've seen the picture with me with it stuck on my face.
Yeah.
You know, that came off of a black drum. But they actually are, they're not a parasite, but they're definitely opportunistic where they actually use that sucker to hang on to a fish. They don't hurt the fish, but what they do is hang out. So when the fish starts feeding and scraps it, either break off, or if they spook little minnows, like in the case of a black drum, it spooks minnows off the bottom, the remora will go over there and eat it.
Yeah, believe it or not, there's a lot of remoras in the harbor. They're not prevalent that much on black drums, but a lot of the small bull sharks up to 5-6 feet here have remoras on them, like at least one or two.
And so do the cobia.
There you go. Okay. Cobia have them as well.
Now, cobia, a cool part about cobia is that, okay, we're going to talk about the largest ones.
Mm-hmm.
Targeting them is tricky in some aspects, but it is a fish that can be found in pretty much all of the tropical oceans.
Right. Just
what,
like a triple
what
tail.
What is big?
The world record's like 130 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
So a big one in Southwest Florida would be 60 plus pounds.
And... can you clarify, Robert, is that like inshore and in the harbor? Or
in
is
the
that
harbor.
In the harbor, 60 pounds?
The biggest one I've ever personally seen was caught off of Lashley Park.
Wow. Lashley Park Pier?
Yeah, which is 20 miles from the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico.
The largest one you saw caught was there?
That actually landed.
Uh-huh.
That was landed. You know, I've seen photographs, I've heard stories, but physically seeing one, this one topped out a 60-pound boger grip, just barely. So I'd have to put it in that 65 to 70-pound mark.
You were there at the pier and saw it?
I was here at the shop when he walked in with it, and he had just landed it. The fish was still alive.
Wow.
He brought it here to see if we had a big enough scale, and at the time, all we had was a 60-pound boger grip.
What time of the... like, when was this? In the 90s?
This was actually only probably about 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
Probably about 8 or 10 years ago, now that I think about it. But
that's a heck of a catch in...
yeah,
inshore, like wow, because that's huge for offshore as well,
right? And for people listening in other places, you know, the cobia is also called a ling or a crab eater in a lot of other locations, and in some places they call them lemon fish, but ling is a really, really common name. Yeah. Other places, especially on
Louisiana,
the Northeast, yeah. Louisiana, and even in parts of the Pacific. So
do you know what that guy caught it on? Did he tell you?
A whiting.
Okay. Answers
same
my question.
Same thing we catch most of the big cobia on in the harbor.
I was just going to say one of my biggest cobia. It's a little, what do you call it, a little foreshadowing, is that's what I caught one of my biggest Kobe on. It was actually last May.
Yeah.
It was on a whiting. But I didn't say that. We have to keep the show going. So, do a spoiler alert.
How would you target the largest cobia? Because going cobia fishing and targeting the largest cobia really kind of are two totally different ballgames.
It's true. It's very true. I would say a pattern I feel like that goes on in this harbor, specifically the harbor. I'm not talking about the reefs and offshore. I have a strong belief that, especially in the spring, in the months of April and May, it feels like everything in spring is like reproducing and mating. And that's when you'll catch the most of like whiting. Whiting, it seems like, are everywhere. And I feel like they move up into the harbor. You can catch them over any part of dirt bottom, whether it be off Gilchrist Pier, off Bayshore Pier, any of these piers. And these cobia gorge themselves because they're full of eggs and they love whiting. Because it's happened so many times, like growing up and fishing these piers, I'll have ladyfish out. Kobe will eat anything, as you know, Robert. You'll have catfish, ladyfish, chunks of mullet. Yes, they'll catch cobia here and there, but it seems like whoever has a whiting on will get smacked over and over and over again. And it doesn't have to do with the location of the person fishing on the pier. It's the person with the whiting on always gets hit.
Yeah, that's like the M&M for a kid on a plate of food.
That's the perfect way to describe it. They're always going to go and hunt the whiting and like leave other baits alone. That's like, I've seen it happen so many times that I'm like, this is not just like a, you
10
know.
10 rods out, all the same distance out, all with different baits on it, and the whiting will catch. You get usually either hit first or the biggest.
Yes. And
I don't, one or the other.
I don't know if that pattern happens in other places, such as Tampa Bay or other places, parts of Florida, but whiting is like, it's, and it doesn't look like much. It's just like this little brown fish. I mean, at least in the harbor, they're brown. I know on the
everywhere
beach,
else they call them Gulf Kingfish.
There you go.
So they're a surf-dwelling, bottom dweller. They actually, for anyone who's a freshwater fisherman, they actually look a lot like a sucker.
Right.
Some people will even have confused them in the past as a baby bonefish.
Yeah.
They have very much a flat, kind of semi-streamlined body with their mouth on the bottom.
Right.
So.
And out of all the bait fish there are to use, like, you know, pinfish, mullet, ladyfish, all those other fish, like, honestly, a whiting is low on my list to use. Because they don't look like much. They're brown and they have a weird shaped nose. And I just don't really think to use them until I've seen.
Until you decide to go cobia fishing.
Yes. That's like when I'm like, all right, time. Now I'm programmed, just put one of those on if I'm going for a big cobia.
Well, so. Usually if people are going just general broad spectrum cobia fishing, I will always tell them to take sardines, mullet, or ladyfish to start off with.
Yeah.
And then take their small bag of frozen shrimp with them, or even live shrimp, and try to catch themselves a whiting. But that way you've already got bait out in the water to increase your chances of catching one.
Right.
But the moment you catch a whiting, that goes on a rod.
Yeah, don't.
Even if you only have one rod, the whiting goes off.
Yes.
Everything else gets set aside.
Yes. And Alex, you've seen, have you caught one yet since your short time here in Florida?
I have not caught a cobia. No, I have not.
The biggest cobia I ever saw swimming alive on that flat right behind your place. It was a 70-pounder.
Along the road when you drive in, that flat?
No, on the harbor side.
Okay. That
whole sandbar out there. Mm.
They're usually in pairs,
it
right?
It was a 70-plus pound fish.
Wow.
It was giant.
Are you kidding me?
No.
It was on its way to your house, Barry.
No, it was going the other direction.
It was on its way to your house.
Yeah.
It was going the other direction.
Oh.
But it was still, to this date, the largest cobia, and that was only about within the last 6-8 years.
Oh, my God. Gosh, I would lose my mind. I mean, I honestly think I've seen one that big in the harbor. I had one crazy day back when I was like a teenager, like maybe 15, 16 years old. This is a little fish story, but we were in the mangroves on the east wall, and we were catching, this was before Hurricane Charlie. Mm-hmm. There used to be those two islands. One of them is no longer there because Hurricane Charlie just wrecked it, and there's no mangroves there anymore. But
Crab Trap.
What's that?
Crab Trap is what it used to be called.
Really? Yes,
the one on the northern end, closer to Alligator Creek, that was called just Crab Trap, because they actually had all those abandoned crab traps behind it.
Yes, I thought that was like the little reef, and that's the exact one, because no one really paid attention to that. It looked like a bunch of little rocks back there, but the redfish, snook, and trout would circle that over and over again. It doesn't exist anymore, the Crab Trap Island. And we were, that day we had tons of big thread fins. They were in the harbor. It was in the fall. It was in November, believe it or not. Almost like where we were approaching. And we were catching, this is when you could keep snook, redfish, and trout. We had already limited out. Like, there was an amazing day. And we were just having fun, and the guy I was fishing with, we're in a 2 feet of water. He was reeling in one of the biggest trout I think I've ever seen. It ate a huge thread fin, like one of those monster thread fin. And as he was reeling it in, it was on the surface just like doing the trout thing, shaking its head, and we're freaking out because how big it was. And out of like the corner of my eye, I just see this brown shadow like shoot from under the boat. For, you know, I just thought it was a shark because it was so big. And it ate this trout like 5 feet from the boat. It like, and it, when I say ate it, it sucked down. I'm not exaggerating. I've seen a lot of trout. This trout was in that 26 to 28 inch range, like a big trout. It sucked it in one like bite and just sat there for a second. And we all got to see the fish. Like, this cobia is in only a foot and a half water. We thought it was a shark. And then it hit us that this big animal is a cobia.
Right.
And it was, no lie, like 5 feet. I'm not kidding, because it was such shallow. I saw the whole thing, and I had the net in my hand, and we were just looking at each other like, what do we do? Like, I was ecstatic it was this big of a cobia, and that cobia just took off and just, like, almost spooled him, and then just, he had 20-pound leader, and it ended up popping on him before we could, I was picking up the anchor, so we'd go chase it down, but that was the biggest cobia I have ever seen in my life, and it was in a foot and a half of water on the east wall in November.
Right. No, and that's a pretty cool story, and that's usually, honestly, the primary way of how you're going to see the biggest cobia, but hooking them is, you know, if you're a land-based angler for cobia, doing the whiting thing and stuff like that is probably the best way to catch a cobia.
Yes.
But to physically catch the largest cobia, one, your largest cobia congregation, like, known worldwide, occurs up in the panhandle area, mm-hmm. in the springtime when they go into a spawn, and they'll be swimming in groups of 2 to 100 fish, and they follow the manta rays, and people actually go out and sight cast them with lures and also eels. They use a lot of live eels because that's like one of the most favorite baits of cobia. So to do it here honestly requires doing the same thing. If you really want to try to catch the largest cobia you can in, say, Charlotte Harbor, where our own backyard is, I'm going to suggest you have to have a boat, and you're going to burn a lot of gas and a lot of time, uh-huh. a lot of eye strain. Because you're going to basically run the edges of the flats looking for these cobia that are swimming in singles and doubles, because they usually are associated with 2 or 3 fish, not always by themselves. Mm. Whether it's a really large cobia or a small cobia, they're almost always in pairs or triples.
Yeah.
You size relative to not one really. Another? No?
Nope. Sometimes there's a 24-incher swimming with a 40-incher.
Yeah. There can be size discrepancies big time.
Yeah, it's not like your other schooling fish where they're all pretty close to the same size. They vary significantly. But what you're going to do is basically you're going to run the edges of the sandbar in 4 or 5 feet of water, enough where you have good visibility down, and be looking for those fish and actually passing them and setting up either your drift or trolling motor and turning around and trying to sight cast to them. Mm. And that's, I mean, It's unfortunate because it is really, really a hard species to target the largest one, especially fishing from shore.
Yeah.
But, you know, running and gunning and looking for them, because most of the time, you know, it's like they talk about sharks being, you know, kind of the tax man or the man in the gray suit. You know, I call them a gray ghost because they just show up out of nowhere. So it's kind of like bonefish are called a gray ghost. Because they're there, and then they're gone. They just, where'd they come from, I have no idea. But cobia relatively do the same thing.
Yeah.
You can be anchored out on a reef 5 miles offshore or 55 miles offshore, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, 2 or 3 giant cobia swim up to the boat. Or you look down and they're sitting underneath the boat, because they are very much a structure-oriented fish. They like shadows. They like to be found around channel markers.
Kind of like a triple tail, right? Uh-huh. A little bit. Kind of like in the same
area. Very, very, very similar. You know, so they're a very hard to target, the biggest of them. But if I had to do it, I'd be going up to, like, Destin and the Panhandle in the springtime and doing the sight fishing thing. They're actually, the Panhandle, they are actually probably one of the sole reasons why Florida had to change the size limit and bag limit of cobia, because it used to be 2 per person per day.
Yeah.
And then they actually changed it to 1 per person per day or 2 per boat.
2 per boat, yeah, that's not...
Which, basically, they brought it down to the equivalent of, like, shark regulations. Mm-hmm. You know, because up in the Panhandle, those guys would run a trip with 6 guys on a boat.
2 per person, right?
And they would catch 2 per person. And these fish, the average size cobia for up there in the springtime was 60 pounds.
Jeez, to have 2, oh my God.
40 pounders were considered small.
Yeah.
50 and 60s were considered pretty much about average. 70 to 80 pounds were considered big. And 90 pounders and 100 pounders were starting to reach the stretch, but they would still catch them. But these guys would run 2 or 3 charters a day with 6 anglers per boat at 2 fish apiece.
Jeez.
So you're talking a minimum of a dozen large breeding size cobia on one angler, on one boat trip.
A day, or just one day, yeah.
Just one charter. But if he had double charters, now you're talking 24 fish.
24, 30 fish, yeah.
You know, and back then I even think that there was a mate and captain limit too, but I'm not 100% on that one, but I know for sure it was 2 per person.
Yeah.
So they actually had to pass that law to reduce the catches of those fish, because we were taking so many of those big breeders, because that's what they were there for, was to spawn. And they followed the manta rays, which I would just really truly like to see a manta ray live and in person, because I've never seen a true manta ray ever.
Wow. They do something interesting with stingrays, the cobia.
That's what you've heard?
Oh, yes, I've heard. I've never personally seen a cobia bump a stingray and do a force birth.
Yeah.
What? What happens? This is news to me.
So I think Robert's trying to tell me that I'm wrong, but apparently cobia will go up and, like, nose bump with their nose, bump a stingray, and it forces the stingray to let go of an offspring, which they eat.
Like the cow nose in the harbor, or is this like
a regular stingray?
Would you say southern, or
yeah, like a southern or Atlantic stingray?
So it's like a little Pez dispenser, and he just goes.
Yeah, honestly, that's more of a wives' tale, because cobia so often are following large stingrays that people will say that, and they do eat small stingrays. Don't get me wrong; they'll take advantage of it if that ray is giving birth. They will fully take advantage of it. But as far as documented proof of it actually causing
the stingray, that's a pretty good stretch of the imagination to say, well, yes, they go up and they hit it like a question mark break in Mario Brothers, and little baby stingrays pop out.
Coins.
Exactly. And that's what it boils down to, is I think it's just because so many people see them following stingrays, and it is in the springtime when stingrays are giving birth, and there's a lot of baby stingrays out on the flats. They see that cobia following the stingray. They see the babies around. They associate it with that. But the reality is that the main reason why cobia follow stingrays and manatees and other fish is that they are kind of... Exactly. Those stingrays swimming along the bottom and gently kissing the bottom with their wingtips and disturbing that sand, or their giant shadow coming over, spooks little bait fish, little shrimp, and little crabs all get exposed as they go by, and those cobia take advantage of that and sweep in and grab those disoriented bait fish and crustaceans that the rays are spooking up. Because you'll almost never see a cobia following groups of cow nose rays, which are associated with swimming in the open water. They don't come close to the bottom. They're surface to subsurface type
And maybe because they only have one offspring, while the other stingrays are chock full of little babies.
Right. Perfect, exactly.
I was going to say, now that you bring that up, Robert, I've looked so many times behind cow nose, especially when they're like thick in the harbor in like the months of April and May. I have yet to see one on trailing a cow nose. I have seen them behind manatees, bull sharks on the flat, stink like the southern stingrays, but I have yet to see them on a cow nose. And right. I've seen them, I feel like a million cow nose in the harbor, and I've never seen it once yet.
And even the big spotted eagle rays, seen one.
I've seen that happen once.
I've only seen one cobia follow on a spotted eagle ray.
Yeah.
And that was about, power pole reef, so
I was just going to say
8 miles offshore.
Yeah.
Do they swim with a fin up out of the water? Is that how cobia? You're able to spot them?
The cobia?
Uh-huh.
They will once in a while, but they're really right up close to the surface. But most of the time, they're just below the surface, so you'll see them. That's why I always say about that 4 to 5 foot of water is what you're looking for, because that's where you have your maximum depth penetration in and around the harbor where you can see them.
Yeah.
Because you're looking for the largest one. So a 24-incher isn't going to stand out in 4 or 5 feet of water, but a 3 to 5 footer will.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Alex, cobia don't have like a prominent dorsal fin. So if they're even cruising the top of the water column, if anything, they'll maybe make I've seen them do it like, it's like a wake. You'll see a V coming through the water, but you won't see like a fin, like a stingray fin or shark fin. It's going to be more of like a wake. They can literally be right under the surface, and they have those like little sticky barbs that stick out of the water. That's
little double horns on their back.
Right. That's just enough to make a little V shape in the water, and that's it. You won't see anything crazy to distinguish them. You'll just see like this V. So that's all it looks like.
So what do you think? 4,000, 6,000 root size reel?
For the bigger, if we're talking about the biggest one, yeah, I would say minimum like a 6,000 size reel, a spinning reel at least. That can, and you're going to be fighting it mainly in open water. So yeah. I would say 50-pound braid is more than enough.
50-pound braid or 20 or 30-pound monofilament is fine.
Yeah.
And I'd be using like probably a 60-pound leader.
That's it, yeah.
Because they don't have teeth, but right. They do have some serious sandpaper for teeth, so they will chafe up your line. So I'm still going to use 60, you know, and anything you want to throw at them, because when they're hungry, they will eat anything. But my favorite lure to throw at a cobia when searching for them is going to be like a 1 ounce bucktail with a 7 to 8 inch black or purple worm attached to that hook as a teaser. Mm. Just because, I mean, one of their favorite foods to eat is eels. So even some of the eel imitations out there work really well.
Yeah.
But there's something about that bucktail eel combination works well. And I can cast it a long way. So I'm using a 7.5 or an 8 foot rod, because you are having to make those longer casts to keep from spooking them.
Right. And one little technique I wanted to throw in there, Robert, is cobia sometimes, if they're being picky and all they're doing is following that jig to the boat and they're not eating it, when they're following it, drop it. Let it go to the bottom. Because mm-hmm. that's like drives an instinct in them to just pin it on the bottom, and they'll grab it then, because it can be so frustrating to see them follow, and they just don't eat it. They'll literally have their nose touching the lure, but they won't eat it. So let it free fall straight to the bottom, and that usually gets a reaction bite out of them. But what were you going to say, Alex? I just wanted to throw that out there in case
real
someone...
quick, we talked about bag limits. I think the max or the minimum length is 33.
To the fork.
To the fork.
Yeah.
Okay. And also, let's just real quickly mention how good they taste.
They're one of the best table fare around.
It's my favorite
They're
fish.
They're absolutely amazing. And the difference between a farm-raised cobia, which they do all over the world, versus wild caught, two totally different animals. So, but they are an amazing fish to eat too.
My absolute favorite. So, well, thank you guys for joining us for another episode of Big Fish Radio. I hope this was helpful to all you guys, and you can catch a cobia of a lifetime, because they are delicious, as we just said, and
and an amazing fight too.
Yeah, they actually do fight really well. From Miss Alex B. Fishin, Robert Lugowitz, and me, Captain Barry, we will see you in the next episode. And for any new fishing updates, you can check out tarponworld.com, and we'll see you there.
get